I saw these people in the, Melbourne Central about a year ago who really bullied me, and they were asking me what I was doing. They actually asked me if I moved down to work at Kmart. Like, because I used to work at Kmart when I was at uni. And they said, oh, did you come down and work at Kmart here? And I said, no.
I have my master's.
Yeah, I have my master's. And I'm a writer. And they're like, oh, what are you writing? I said, I'm writing a book. And I said, I'm writing a book about being bullied.
By you.
And it just went over their head.
Hello and welcome to this In Conversation episode of Shameless. This week, Zara and I are joined by Carly Finlay, a media personality with a unique story and voice. Most people would introduce Carly as a disability advocate, but in truth, she is so much more than that. She's an author, a podcaster, and a generally really wonderful human being.
For those unaware, Carly has a genetic condition called ichthyosis, which changes the appearance and texture of her skin. It's Carly's experience with ichthyosis that has made her a passionate advocate for disability awareness and visibility.
Here's Carly. Carly.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the book as well. We posted about our book on our Instagram stories, and we had a lot of messages of people saying, are you interviewing Carly?
Thank you. It's been very exciting. I got my big box of books today.
Oh, amazing. I saw on Instagram you were doing that thing where you, every time you got a parcel from the book publisher, you're like, is it my book?
Yeah. And it wasn't. Like, I thought the first one was my book.
Yeah.
But it was someone else's book. And Australia Post were very kind in filming me.
Oh.
My podcast co-host, Jason, said he thinks the winner of this whole situation is Australia Post in that they don't have to film me anymore opening parcels.
That's true. And great publicity for Australia Post, getting on your Instagram.
And also good publicity for the other authors. They all had a laugh at it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Carly, we start every interview in the same way, and that is, what have you been reading, watching and listening to this week?
So I have just finished Troll Hunting by Ginger Gorman. It was incredible. Yeah, she's an incredible journalist, and she wrote about cyber hate, and she interviewed me for Troll Hunting, actually. There's a funny story in the book. She mentions it in the book that we were at the same conference together a couple of years ago, and I was pretty sore, and I said to her, I'm going to be in my pyjamas, if that's all right, come up to my hotel room. So she brought her pyjamas too. And then my mum was there, and mum ordered room service and got wine and pizza, and we had like a pyjama party. But then I was left with the bill. Anyway, it was really fun, and that book is amazing. Ginger does a really great job in talking about hard issues in quite a light way.
So is it quite conversational? Does she interview trolls as well?
Yeah. She actually forms a friendship with one of the trolls.
Wow.
And then she has an ongoing kind of relationship with a few of the trolls, and that's really uneasy. Like, just, it's really creepy. Yeah.
I think we need to get onto that one, Michelle.
It's really, really great. I think it's out in February.
Okay. So, yeah. And what about podcasts? Are you interested in podcasts?
Yeah, I love podcasts. I've been listening to Broken Hearts.
Ah, yes.
And I've been trying to avoid crime podcasts because I think that they perpetuate violence against women a lot. So if I do listen to the crime podcasts, and I haven't given up entirely, I listen to Trace by the ABC because I think that's really ethically made, and that's really incredible. But Big Hearts is a collaboration between Glamour and I don't know, We Heart Radio, I think. And it's about a family who were all the children were all black American children who were adopted by two white women. And outwardly on their social media, they would, the white women would say Black Lives Matter and we're doing our best to build communities for our children. But there was an apparent murder-suicide in 2018 in April where the women drove the children off the cliffs and all of them died. And it's come to light that these children were abused, and nothing that they would put outwardly on social media reflected the reality of it. And so I think they've found the bodies of four of the children, and two of them are still missing. But it's incredible. One of the things that I'm really interested in is hearing about the white saviourism in this, and like they've addressed it. They're two white women doing the podcast. The podcasters are two white women, and they're probably not the best people to talk about black representation and community. So they've got a lot of black people to talk about things, and it's really, really interesting. So I highly recommend it.
I've seen that in the charts, but I just had not, I didn't know what it was about. I think
it's a really fascinating story.
The family is the heart family, H-A-R-T. So, yeah.
One thing that really caught my attention when I was reading your book was your discussion of race, because your mum is a woman of colour and your dad is Caucasian. And I found it so interesting when you were discussing the fact that your skin is red by the fact that you have a skin condition called ichthyosis. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to elaborate a bit on that for us, that identity with race?
Yes, I guess when I was younger, you know, my arms are very are not very red at all. They're just, they just look quite untanned. And I would ask kids, if my skin wasn't red, what do you think, it would be black or white? Because my parents, and they'd always say, oh, white, of course, because, you know, it's bad to be black, especially in a, it's not bad to be black, but they thought it's bad to be black in a small town like I grew up in, and they never imagined that there was a possibility I could be black because my mother's black. They saw white as the superior race, and I didn't really particularly grow up with a lot of South African people around me, but we did go to Melbourne and Sydney a lot, where we had South African friends, so I had that influence. But I think my growing up was very, very Australian, very white. And so I hadn't really explored the idea of being a woman of colour until recently. But then I got asked to write a couple of pieces on race and identity, and I have written for Growing Up African in Australia. So,
what were you like as a kid? What was your personality like?
I think I was pretty loud. Like, I was often told to be quiet, to be quiet a lot. I mean, now I'm a speaker.
Yeah.
but I think I was also a bit frustrated that children didn't want to be friends with me. You know, that I couldn't quite articulate what I needed to teachers. Like, if I needed not to be in the sun while people were playing sport, because I didn't identify as disabled then, I couldn't say, well, I really need this, and it's not fair of you to leave me out in the sun when I'm needing just to go in the library. So I couldn't really articulate that because I didn't really have that identity. Also, I had really short hair, really, really short hair. One of the symptoms of ichthyosis is hair breakage, and I'd often have these patches on my head and these kind of lopsided pigtails and stuff, and I didn't like being mistaken for a boy and then teased because I was red. And also I wanted to be more feminine, I think, you know, like I didn't want something else to be different about me. I just wanted long hair. I think my doctor, George, he's still my doctor, he said in my file when I was in hospital, very, very young, my goal in life was to have long hair. It's actually quite good now. It's actually, you know, I do image descriptions on my photos, are saying I need to, because I describe myself as a woman with a red face and short, dark, curly hair. People said I have to change the short, dark, curly hair bit.
Yeah, it's not short anymore.
Long, dark, short, curly hair. Carly, I was going to ask you about those image descriptions because I've seen you and a few other people that I've followed. I was going to say, we didn't even ask any about that last week, but we intended to. Mm-hmm. Where was that born from, and what is the idea behind it for people on social media? Yeah. And why would you encourage anyone else to do the same?
Yeah, so image descriptions are just a description of the image. So if I was to describe how I look now as I sit down here, I would say woman with red face, which is factual, and people often go off at me for describing myself as a woman with a red face, but I'm like, but that's factual, it's not offensive.
How dare you own your own description as well.
Exactly. So woman with red face, short, dark, curly hair, wearing colourful clothes, sitting in front of a microphone. So it's as simple as that. And it is for people who cannot see or use screen read and or use screen readers, which like read out what is happening on the screen. So when you're making a website or uploading a picture to a news site, for example, there's an alt text option. So the alt text is a version of that image description. So when people hover their mouse over or highlight the alt text, that can either show the alt text on the screen or they can hear it with their screen reader. I decided to do it because I identify as disabled, and a lot of my audience is disabled as well. So I don't want to alienate them. And I reckon I've been doing it for about a year now, constantly. And I used to do it for a job that I worked in, and I thought, well, I may as well do it on my own social media. I don't do it for everything because sometimes I don't have time. And actually, I was pretty disappointed when I was on holidays. I was trying not to do activism, and someone complained about my image description, and I just thought, well, I'm doing it anyway. I'm on holidays, and it's actually not my job to do it all the time on, you know.
Isn't that a classic case of not doing everything perfectly? You know, you do good thing and then people, the bar is so high all the time.
Yeah, I've written about that in my book as well, I think when you write something on social media, you're accountable for that for the rest of your life.
And it is, people assume it's your entire identity, that activism might be your entire identity. Mm.
Does it feel, you did discuss a little bit, we've seen you discuss on your blog as well, that it is a bit fatiguing writing this memoir, and it obviously requires a lot of you and to open up a lot about your life and invite people in. Mm. How did you navigate those feelings, and how are you feeling now that the book's out and you're doing publicity rounds, you're speaking to people like us? How are you coping with that?
It was really fatiguing, actually. It was like, it's such a big job, and I did it on top of my job as well. I have a part-time job, and then I do writing and speaking as well, so that makes it a full-time job, and then I was doing my book on top of that, and it was really a lot of work. It took 2 years to do, not entire, some of it I was just waiting to get edits back or whatever. And there was, I work at Melbourne Fringe, so the festival is in September, and there was one round of edits, which was quite big, that I did the whole edits in, wrote the whole third draft, the next draft, in festival time.
And that was oh my gosh,
that was a bit silly. I think it was hard to sort of draw on things like from, my childhood that I might not have wanted to think about for a while, or even thinking about how I could have done something better, how I wasn't a particularly nice person then, or reflecting on that stuff. One of the really hard things has been the tall poppy syndrome, which has been quite yucky and unexpected as well. I think that there's an idea amongst marginalised groups that there's only enough pie for one person, but there's enough pie for everyone.
I read, I think it was on your blog, and I really loved this quote. I think a friend had told you that in order to create change, you sort of have to have one foot in the margins and one foot in the mainstream. Yeah. Tell us about your experience with that.
Yeah, an ex-friend told me that I can either be mainstream or do activism. I can't do both. And I guess from then I felt really pushed out, and I felt like I was made to choose, and I don't speak to those people anymore. Some of it through my choice, most of it not. And it's been really, really hard, lonely, really lonely, and, I guess that they think my work's problematic because I'm not doing it in a certain way. And I think some disabled people don't want you to win awards or don't want you to have mainstream success, but then what are we fighting for? I'm getting paid, I'm in the mainstream. That's what everyone has been fighting for. And I also don't want to take over someone else's voice. I want to put voices forward, and I've tried to do that in my book, in interviewing people and, showcasing other voices. There's a whole list of people at the back that people can refer to. And I've said that this is just my opinion. It's not everyone else's. So,
I think as well, when it comes to activism, it's all well and good to say don't go mainstream, but if we just speak to the same corners of the world and we all stay in our little areas, we're never educating anyone, we're never reaching anyone who disagrees with us, and that's so dangerous and just almost pointless. If you're never going to speak to anyone outside and try and spread awareness, what is the point?
I agree. You can't get in that bubble of you can't get in that bubble.
In the book, there's a great part where you talk about the media's treatment of disabled people, and in particular how shows like Embarrassing Bodies or whatever it might be use shock value for entertainment. What's been your experience like with what you sometimes call the exploitative media?
Not recently, because I tell everyone to fuck off.
But that is the correct way to go about things.
But there was a period, probably for about 3 years, I would say, that every 1 or 2 months I would get a request to go on an exploitative show, like Body Bazaar or Embarrassing Bodies or Medical Incredible or some show. And it would be weird people like on Instagram, hey, I'm a journalist and I follow you and you're so inspirational and we want to show you, we want to raise awareness. And so I've always said no, and I've developed this series of questions which are in the book, and I send them back. And the questions are things like, do you pay? Will you zoom in on my skin and make it awkward? How do you speak about disability? Do you have a disabled narrator? Are you able to get me to narrate it? Can I put this on my blog? So then they don't know what to say, and then I get no response back. But I know a lot of people with ichthyosis, skin conditions, facial differences and other disability who think that awareness raising is absolute key, especially the parents, and they just put their kids forward on these shows. And I think the problem is twofold, because it's the show that's exploitative with the title and the content. Embarrassing Bodies sets the tone.
Absolutely.
You know, already. Such a disgraceful headline when you, like, or title when you think about it.
And also the commentary around it is problematic. So when my – and I wrote about this in the book, a friend – put her son on a show by Barcroft Media, and the comments were awful, and I hope that that little boy never has to see them. And I wrote to Barcroft and I said, how can you be so responsible? You're raising awareness and trying to do a good story, but you're leaving these comments up, telling this little boy that he should be dead. So that's really problematic. And I actually don't have a lot of respect for parents that put their children on social media for the point of awareness raising and then go to mainstream media. There's a little girl in America at the moment who has ichthyosis, and her mum is putting her on every single news outlet out there. Every time my Google alert for ichthyosis comes up, she's on there again, and she gets the most horrendous comments. And when I've reached out to her to say, hey, I think your little girl deserves some privacy and the choice to tell her story, I've been blocked.
Really? Yeah. When you send those questions to the network or the journalist, do you ever have any intention of going on the show at all, or is it just for the purpose of putting them back in their place?
Putting them back in their place, yeah. I'm pretty selective with what sort of media I do. And I was saying in another interview, actually, when I was this is a tangent, my photo got misused on Reddit, which is you can read about in the book, but I had a lot of media contact me that I don't want to deal with. You know, I don't usually want to deal with.
Like Daily Mail?
Daily Mail, yeah.
Are we going to be anonymous about this, or are we going to name and shame?
And they, to be honest, they, you know, I said, no, I don't want any, I don't want an article. They wrote it anyway. And the comments were probably the nicest out of all of the comments.
Really? Yeah. Shocking.
Yeah. And when last year, when I had a difficult interview with an ABC host, I had heaps of media contact me. Like it was, you know, a lot. And I chose, on the advice of my agent, to do two interviews. I did the project and I did the Age. And but the other people, it was very. I think actually the Daily Mail did email me and or message me on Facebook, and I just had a real standard response. Like, this is the photo I want used. Mm-hmm. I'll have I had a one sentence or something that I said to all of these people instead of giving them a big interview. And then I think the Daily Mail email messaged me back going, oh, we've chosen this photo from your Facebook. I said, no, you can use this photo or nothing. And they did.
And they did follow that?
Yeah.
This is new.
I think, but
the power you hold over the Daily Mail,
there was something better that happened, actually. After You Can't Ask That, I did You Can't Ask That, which is a series of questions, a show about, you know, with a series of questions that people ask me, and so that showed the taboo kind of things that were asked. And the day after that, there was a heap of media. And I did an article for Daily Life, and then that was reprinted, I think, in some Fairfax papers. But the Daily Mail did this article on those people that were on the facial difference episode, and there was one woman who was burnt in a fire, and she said that one of the quotes was completely taken out of context, and you know, that was used as a headline about it. Like, she said that she doesn't own a camera, and I think that might be because of her age. I don't think that's because of her appearance, but the Daily Mail implied that she doesn't own a camera because she can't handle how she looks.
She's so ashamed of herself, or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so they used my photo and they used some other people's photos. And under the caption, said, Carly's photo was misused on Reddit. And then I said, Carly's photo has now been misused on the Daily Mail. And the journalist that wrote it had followed me on Twitter the night before, and I was up quite late following the commentary around it. So she could have asked me for permission. She could have asked me. Instead, she took all these photos off my social media and put them in there. So the next morning, I tweeted them and I said, you know, you've used my photo without permission, you've taken it, and then you've done this caption that my photo was used without permission. And then someone messaged me to give me the details of some editors, and so I rang one of the editors and I said, hey, so I went on this show last night, and it was about how I talked about how my photo's been misused, and now you have, take my photo down immediately. And they did.
amazing work.
You must be the only person in Australia who can make Daily Mail do anything good.
Next time anything happens, we know who we're calling.
I can tell you, oh gosh, I will tell you this. It's pretty funny. I went out the other night and had some drinks. I wasn't particularly drunk, but one of my friends was drunk, and he was there with his male partner, so he's gay, and he was asking me about my Vaseline and how it would affect, whether it would make his lips soft or something, and he was progressively getting drunker and drunker, and he asked me to kiss him to see what effect this would have on his lips. Anyway, and someone took a photo, and I'm like, God, don't leak that to the Daily Mail.
No, they'll be looking for it now.
I know, right?
Before, when you were talking about Twitter, and you said sometimes, you know, I was reading the commentary around that particular appearance on You Can't Ask That. Mm-hmm. Do you follow commentary about yourself, and what's that like?
Sometimes. I think it's draining, and I think so. When the interview on the ABC happened last year, the commentary on Twitter was incredible, and I just saw things turn around so much. People recognised what ableism was and things, but I actually didn't read any Facebook comments. If people had tagged me in something, I had stopped comments on my blog because I was getting some quite hateful ones actually. But I didn't, and that was making me a bit better. But yeah, I did read them for a long time, and I'd argue back. Sometimes if they're particularly nasty, I'd call someone's employer.
Really? Mm-hmm. That's so interesting, because I think you are very vocal on social media. I mean, it's a big part of your activism.
Yeah.
Do you get drained by that? Yeah. Not just the activism, but having to use social media as its sort of vehicle?
It's also like, if that's your work, being able to switch off from that when social media is so prevalent.
You can't really. And even like when I've been trolled, you know, horrendously, you know, when I've had death threats or rape threats, the police will just say, I just switch off. No, I can't. And they don't understand. They don't, like, that's a lot of what Ginger's book's about. So, yeah, it is tiring. I should get someone to monitor it sometimes, but I mean, I haven't really. People check in on me, people that know what it's like check in. But it's a weird beast, isn't it?
After the break, Carly talks about the emotional labour that comes with doing what she does and the women who inspire her the most. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Before, you touched on the idea that people call you inspirational. Mm-hmm. And in the book, you have a whole chapter on what you called inspiration porn, which I love that term.
And
I
that think term it, was coined by Stella Young. Mm.
Sorry, yeah. Stella Young coined that term, who was a massive influence on your work and one of the reasons you wrote the book as well. Mm-hmm. What I really found interesting was the discussion of the able-bodied gaze. Mm. Would you be able to talk a bit to that?
So I think it's when people without disability, so non-disabled people, look at us as an object of pity or inspiration or an example of, well, if Carly can get out of bed looking like she does, then what am I complaining about? You know, people often use disabled people to put their lives in perspective, which is really hard. You know, a lot of people will say to me or about other people, oh, I'm just so lucky. I'm lucky, they're lucky not to have this condition, or, you know, or it gives me so much perspective about what I can do, and they often make it on
put themselves at the centre of everything.
Yeah, so there is that. And I also think that there's the idea of like being a bit wowed by doing ordinary things. Stella says in her TED talk about inspiration porn that people who are using adaptive equipment or calipers on their legs or, you know, drawing with their mouth because they don't have a hand, they're not doing extraordinary things. They've come to adapt their bodies to do the best that they can. So I think that people without, not non-disabled people, just need to get a new perspective that we're not here, then we're not your teachable moment. We're not here to make you feel better about yourself. Yeah. Because, I mean, there's people that have said to me, oh, I couldn't handle looking like you, or if I was like you, I'd kill myself. And, you know, that projection of their own fear around difference and disability is very telling. It's not just not about me, it's about them.
Yeah, completely.
Someone sent that to me on a date once.
What?
That was awkward.
Said it to you on a date?
Yeah.
This great way to start a date.
Did you just get up and go?
No, I didn't. I think
you're so lovely.
I probably would have now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I
how didn't. Do you deal with it? So in those moments, particularly as you're growing up, because I imagine now that you are married and you've gone through a lot of life, I guess, you're a bit older, but when you're younger, it must have been really hard to deal with that stuff, especially as a teenager or in your 20s, going on dates and hearing that from men. Yeah. How did you learn to deal with it?
I I was trying, like, my parents always used to teach me to be really matter of fact, like, I was born like this, it's not contagious, or I'm not, you know, don't worry about me kind of thing. So that was useful. And then I think there's this expectation that we shouldn't get angry, that we should just take it, that we should be polite, that we should be a teachable moment to everyone. And you know, I've had people say, when I've written about this stuff and how I deal with ableism, and if I'm rude, if I tell someone to fuck off, which I sometimes do, people will say, well, maybe that was their only experience of someone with disability, and then they'll never want to speak to a disabled person again. And I'm like, but that's not my problem, that's their problem.
Like, so you're responsible to educate the entire world, despite them being all ignorant and fuckwits.
I had a person at the start of last year email me, message me on Facebook, and from her photo, I'd say she was a lot older than me. She might have been in her 50s or 60s. And she said, my mother has always told me to look away from someone with a facial difference, but you say that we should say hello. What should I do? Anyway, so I had a lot going on on that weekend. So that was about, I don't know, 11 o'clock on a Friday night. It was quite late and I did not respond. And I was thinking about it, you know, thinking about a response and thinking that this would be useful for the book. And then the next night at about the same time, she says, well, given you didn't reply, I know your answer. I am never going to look at or talk to anyone with a facial difference again.
Oh, my God.
And it was so rude. I think I wrote about it in the book. And I just said to – I said to her, you know, it's not my job to make you be a better person. Like, I'm not the instructor of how you should behave.
It's such a mental and emotional load to carry that simply by existing, you need to help other people get better all the time.
Yeah. And even on Twitter this morning, there was this great hashtag called Things Disabled People Know, and I was taking part in it, and I said something about, like, the use of the word, like, the use of disability as identity, and I've had so many people tell me off, and I've learnt this, and this is what I, you know, this is what I think, and I said, you know, just shut up and listen. And there was this person who said something like, oh, I was told I shouldn't use people with disability. And I gave them a couple of examples and I said, oh, and also Google, not just me. And then they said, this is what I get when I Google. And then someone else joined in the conversation, a prominent author, and she goes, you be you, go be a ham sandwich, like, fuck off. And I actually wrote back and I said, you are so rude. We've taken the time to educate you about our identity and you've told us to go be a ham sandwich?
That's bizarre. People, when people go on the internet, they become just,
I know.
It's even like, and as a parallel, it's like the violence against women thing. Yesterday we posted something from Clementine Ford about feminism, violence against women, and a murder that occurred this week. Mm. And a man responded saying, well, if you were less patronising towards men, maybe we would listen to you, and why do you come at us and accuse us of X, Y, and Z?
He said, have you ever thought of supporting somebody who has these tendencies? No.
As if, like,
no, I absolutely have not.
As if it's somehow our fault that you're an asshole.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. And I'm really tired. Really tired. Yeah. And actually my editor asked me to write more on emotional labour in the book. Mm. I wrote back, I don't want to do this. I'm
that
too
is
much
emotional labour.
No, right. And just doing that is emotional labour. And I sent her a picture of Hannah Gadsby saying I identify as tired. Can I just have this as a chapter?
Do you think, I mean, when you talk, I think a conversation we don't have around activism enough is the longevity of it. I mean, how long do you think you're going to need to take breaks to sort of not be as tired, or how long do you see
I've been thinking about this a while. Like, because now I used to have a full-time job at the government, and then my activism work is very separate, and now my activism work is very much a full-time job because I work for Melbourne Fringe as an access and inclusion coordinator, and I do writing and speaking, and I'm constantly retelling my story, and I wonder how long. I don't know. But I also think that I have there's a lot of content that I have developed that is useful, and I am pretty tired of having to keep resharing that. Like, you know, people can just use Google. But I do hope that, you know, the legacy that I leave is the content online, and the constant, like, the amount of it will be useful for people.
For sure. And when you said, I mean, I know when we were talking about you growing up, and you said it for a long time you didn't really identify as disabled, it took till a certain point for you to sort of look back and think about everything. At what point was that, and what kind of conclusion did you come to?
Yeah, so I think it was like when I was in my late 20s when I, a long time. I used to mentor children or young people at the Children's Hospital, the Chronic Illness Peer Support Program, which is a program for 12 to 26-year-olds with chronic illnesses and disability. And I realised that they all had these barriers that I was experiencing. So we might have had different diagnoses. They have diabetes or cystic fibrosis or cerebral palsy. But we all had lots of time with school, found it hard to get a job, all of that sort of stuff.
In the book, you explore your frustration with being offered magic cures by strangers on the internet who pretend to know more about ichthyosis than you do. How does it feel for others to presume that? Presume that you don't, with your team of dermatologists and your team of medical professionals, don't know more about your condition than they do?
I get it in the street, you know, like I get people asking me if I'd like to try their whatever cream in the street. And one day at work when I was in the government, there was this man that came up to me that, like, I worked in this very big team that had versions of my role in every office. So we had this big meeting one day and I'd never met him before. He was a lot older than me. And he we had a chat and he asked me what I did outside of work, and I said, I'm a writer. And I said, he's like, oh, what do you write about? And I thought, oh, I don't really want to go into it now, but I just said, I write about health stuff. He goes, oh, wow, I work in health too. I'm like, right. Anyway, so I said, oh, great. So he, then I got back from lunch and I found these pamphlets on my desk about stem cells, like stem cell tablets or something. And anyway, so I actually, I was reading them and it had this really funny thing about like making your skin look 10 years younger. And I thought, well, my skin already looks 10 years younger because it constantly sheds and renews anyway, which I found really humorous. And I actually rang our like manager to say, hey, this guy has just sent me this stuff, put this stuff on my desk, like presuming that I need it, presuming he can sell it to me. And then he rings me and he says, oh, so I've been researching your condition. How do you pronounce it? And I thought, oh, God. And then he asked me to speak at one of his conferences. And the payment would be these stem cell tablets.
Oh, my God.
And it was at the time when I was just sort of, you know, forging a speaking career. And I told him I was going to charge $500, which was at the time quite expensive for me. Now I wouldn't charge much more. And he goes, oh, no, we could only pay you in pills. And I said, but I can't take these pills because I don't know what's going to happen. And he's like, oh, no, they're safe. They're safe for people with eczema. I said, but I don't have eczema. You've only just found out about
my
condition.
It's a genetic condition.
Yeah, you just found out about it last night. You don't even know how to pronounce it. And then so we had this really silly conversation. And because, you know, you're bound by the code of conduct, I couldn't just tell him to fuck off. But we had to have this whole conversation. And then I said to him, look, I once had some pain in my ears from flying, and the pharmacist who I trust, who has gone through a degree to become a pharmacist, prescribed me some or recommended me some over-the-counter tablets, and then that made my skin very, very sore. Do you think I am going to take your pills when you've probably just done some marketing course, you know, with some cult? Anyway, I didn't tell him that. But, you know. So there's that. There's constantly having to argue that I know more, and I'm finding more and more and as people are selling things like, I don't know, I think it's called Unique online and Roads and Fields products. I'm going to name them. I think it's Roads and Fields. What's the other one? Anyway, they're constantly, doTERRA, constantly doing these multi-level marketing schemes. And when I use hashtags to identify myself as having ichthyosis or skin condition, which is so that other people with those conditions can find me, that's it's not for the benefit of multi-level marketers. It's to be visible and it's to be findable. I get a lot of people messaging me going, hey, I'm a Roads and Fields consultant and I've got some creams for you. And then when I come back with an answer and then, like, my followers will get onto them, they're like, oh, I'm just a small-time mom just wanting to look after my son. And I'm like, you wouldn't have even known ichthyosis. I've got this idea for a story. I probably shouldn't tell you this on the air, but I've got an idea for a story about multi-level marketing about how I want to write it.
You should write it.
That would be a great story.
And we have lovely listeners who will not steal it. Contractually obliged to not steal it.
But it's quite ridiculous that people think that they know more about it than me, and that some oil might just
cannabis oil.
Cannabis oil. There's a lot of stories in the news about ichthyosis and cannabis oil. And one, cannabis oil is not legal yet in Australia. I've also talked to my my pain management specialist about it. I go to the pain management clinic once a year, and I talk to them about it. And I said, will it take away the pain? Because apparently people tell me it does. And I think when people self-medicate, it's a little with cannabis, it's a little bit different to having prescribed things, because they're doing it on the sly and they're finding what works for them. Mm. And I'm so anti-drugs, I wouldn't do that. And I don't particularly want to smoke, because that'll just harm everything anyway. Mm. But the doctor said that there's not enough research about cannabis oil to prove that it's going to help me. So I'm just going to use what I've been prescribed. But I joked in the book that I am tagged in a post about cannabis and ichthyosis every week. And it's just false news, because it is a genetic condition. The cannabis oil isn't going to take the redness away. It's not going to cure the condition. It's not going to leave me without ichthyosis. It might alleviate the pain, but...
One of my favourite themes that you discuss in different chapters at different points, mm-hmm. is the idea of friendships, yeah. and how when you do have a disability, mm. friendships can be difficult, because mm-hmm. you could be bullied and isolated from a young age, as mm-hmm. you were in primary school.
Yeah.
And then you can struggle to connect with, trust people, mm. form bonds with people. Mm-hmm. How has that been across your life, and yeah. how do you view friendship now?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think friendship was really hard as a kid, and I was talking to a friend from school yesterday who was also bullied like I was, and we were just talking about all the people that we remember, and how I was saying how I saw these people in the Melbourne Central about a year ago who really bullied me, and they were asking me what I was doing. They actually asked me if I moved down to work at Kmart, because I used to work at Kmart when I was at uni. And they said, "Oh, did you come down and work at Kmart here?" And I said, "No,
my master's."
Yeah, I have my master's, and I'm a writer. And they're like, "Oh, what are you writing?" I said, "I'm writing a book." And then I said, "I'm writing a book about being bullied."
Are you?
Just went over their head.
Yeah.
So that was really hard. And I also said that it was really hard to know how to be a real friend, because I didn't have the experience of friendship. So you can't learn to be a friend when you haven't had a friendship, and so it took me a long time. But I think going to university, working at Kmart really helped. So that, probably 20 years ago, I felt like I had real friends. It took a long time, until I was about 17. I had a few friends on and off, but even then, there was still that level of exclusion. People don't want to be seen with a person that looks different. But now I feel like I meet a lot of people on the internet. Mm. That's how I meet a lot of my friends, and a lot of people with disability as well, who you just identify with, and they just know or empathise what you're going through. So that can be great. I think one of the hard things is often some diagnoses or some impairments have mean that you have a shorter chance at life, which is really hard. So people die prematurely before they should, so that can be really hard.
Mm. I imagine social media for you is a massive double-edged sword then, because you are meeting a lot of great people and a lot of like-minded people, and then you're also copping the brunt of a heap of other stuff too.
Yeah. I think, and there's an expectation to always be on. I just went off at someone actually the other day. They messaged me in the morning. I had a lot of people that haven't said thank you. Just say thank you. It's really easy to say thank you. Asking me to do something like, "Hey, Carly, my baby's got ichthyosis. What do I do?" So I say, "I don't want to give medical advice, but here's a Facebook group you should deal with. You should join, rather. Here's something I wrote." And there's no thank you. And I actually wrote back, "Hey, I've just offered you advice. Like, the first thing I did when I got up was reply to your message, and you can't even muster a thank you."
Mm.
Yeah. that can be hard.
It can be. So we finish the episode in the same way, mm-hmm. every time. Mm-hmm. We would love to know the women in your life, or the women that you look up to that you mm-hmm. admire, because we are always looking for amazing people to follow. And what's next on the horizon for you? What's planned for the year?
Yeah, sure. So women that I admire, there's so many of them. I really love Michelle Roger, who does a great initiative called Up and Dressed, and she is a disabled woman who posts great fashion stuff, and she was involved in Access to Fashion last year with me. I think she's just Michelle_Roger on Instagram. I really like my best friend Curly Pops, who is quite sick at the moment, and she does a lot of sewing and has really cute dog photos, and she does amazing work around transplant and cancer. So follow her. Although don't send her messages. That's my public announcement.
Noted.
Also, people like Alice Wong, who runs the Disability Visibility Project in America. She's incredible. Kia Brown, who's an amazing woman of colour, disabled woman. Valissa Thompson, who another woman of colour, disabled woman. Imani Barbarin, who created that hashtag, Things Disabled People Know. She's great. Eliza Hull, who did that amazing podcast on the ABC called We've Got This around disabled parenting. Jess Walton, who has just written for The Catering Show. She's incredible. Amazing. She does really great things on Twitter. Who else? So many people.
So just, you've got this list. Yeah, done, right? Up your
there's
sleeve.
Actually a list in the back.
People
of
will probably think
well.
That Carly was just reading off a list and that was literally off the top of her head.
Yeah, but there is a... Just look in my acknowledgements in the book.
You know what we'll
and
do?
And you can go and find people.
We'll put that entire list in our recommendations newsletter for people that you can go and follow in the disability space.
Yeah, Yeah, and there's heaps of suggested resources in the back of the book too. And if you read my whole thank you thing in the back, there's heaps of people as well.
Great. We'll definitely put some of those women in our newsletter.
Yeah, great.
For sure.
And what is next on the horizon? Well, I am in the middle of book tour, which is fun. It's actually quite fun.
Are you sick of talking about yourself?
No, not really. I like it.
That's not at all.
You know, I haven't written a book for no one to read it. So
completely.
So doing that, what else? I think... I have got a lot on with this book and with other stuff, and I just want to. I think I just want to have a rest.
Need a holiday.
Go on a holiday.
I just went on a holiday.
I know, but go on another one. You can never take too many
the
holidays.
Limit does not
right?
exist. We only get holidays at the end of the year at Melbourne Fringe, so I'm waiting 11 months. Oh, actually, no, there is something more. I am editing Growing Up Disabled in Australia. And that is a book that that's an anthology by Black Ink Books. So Black Ink do a whole series of growing up books. I was asked to write for Growing Up African, as I said before, and I pitched Growing Up Disabled and they said yes. So we are seeking submissions until 31st of May. I want heaps of disabled people to submit, like all diverse people, old, young, lots of different impairments, lots of different experiences. So I know we've got about 20 submissions so far, so that's really exciting.
Amazing.
And I will be reading every one of them and choosing who will be in it. So that's really exciting.
That's amazing. And our listeners can pick up a copy of your book at any good bookstore.
From the 29th.
From the 29th.
And it is available to pre-order now, carlyfindlay.com.au/sayhello.
You know where to find her.
Yeah.
Carly, you have been... so amazing to
thank
speak
you.
With and we cannot thank you enough. I know you said before about not thanking each other. We are so appreciative.
Thank you.
We are so appreciative of you making the time because you've got a lot on and you didn't need to speak to a small podcast like us.
Oh, you're not.
We're pretty small. And it's a Saturday as well, so we dragged you out here on a Saturday, so we could not appreciate you more. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us for this In Conversation episode of Shameless. If you loved Carly as much as we did, you can follow her on Instagram at Carly Finlay. We also really highly recommend her new book, Say Hello, which is in all good bookstores now. As for us, find Zara and I in the Facebook group, as always, Shameless Podcast Community, or on Instagram at Shameless Podcast. We will be back in your ears next Monday.